only about 25 to 30% of the adult population of Athens enjoyed full political rights. As the size of polities continued to increase, and city-states were superseded by larger kingdoms and empires, even Athenian-style partial democracy disappeared. All the famous examples of ancient democracies are city-states such as Athens and Rome. In contrast, we don't know of any large-scale kingdom or empire that operated along democratic lines. For example, when in the 5th century BCE, Athens expanded from a city-state into an empire, it did not grant citizenship and political rights to those it conquered. The city of Athens remained a limited democracy, but the much bigger Athenian Empire was ruled autocratically from the centre. All the important decisions about taxes, diplomatic alliances, and military expeditions were taken in Athens. Subject lands like the islands of Naxos and Thasos had to obey the orders of the Athenian popular assembly and elected officials, without the Naxians and Thasians being able to vote in that assembly or be elected to office. It was also difficult for Naxos, Thasos, and other subject lands to coordinate a united opposition to the decisions taken in the Athenian centre, and if they tried to do so, it would have brought ruthless Athenian reprisals. Information in the Athenian Empire flowed to and from Athens. When the Roman Republic built its empire, conquering first the Italian peninsula and eventually the entire Mediterranean basin, the Romans took a somewhat different course. Rome gradually did extend citizenship to the conquered people. It began by granting citizenship to the inhabitants of Latium, then to the inhabitants of other Italian regions, and finally to inhabitants of even distant provinces like Gallia and Syria. However, as citizenship was extended to more people, the political rights of citizens were simultaneously restricted. The ancient Romans had a clear understanding of what democracy means, and they were originally fiercely committed to the democratic ideal. After expelling the last king of Rome in 509 BCE, the Romans developed a deep dislike for monarchy and a fear of giving unlimited power to any single individual or institution. Supreme executive power was therefore shared by two consuls who balanced each other. These consuls were chosen by citizens in free elections, held office for a single year, and were additionally checked by the powers of the popular assembly, of the Senate, and of other elected officials like the tribunes. But when Rome extended citizenship to Latins, Italians, and finally to Gauls and Syrians, the power of the popular assembly, the tribunes, the Senate, and even the two consuls was gradually reduced, until in the late 1st century BCE, the Caesar family established its autocratic rule. Anticipating present-day strongmen like Putin, Augustus didn't crown himself king and presented that Rome was still a republic. The Senate and the popular assembly continued to convene, and every year citizens continued to choose consuls and tribunes. But these institutions were emptied of real power. In 212 CE, the emperor Caracalla, the offspring of a Phoenician family from North Africa, took a seemingly momentous step and granted automatic Roman citizenship to all free adult males throughout the vast empire. Rome in the 3rd century CE accordingly had tens of millions of citizens. But by that time, all the important decisions were made by a single unelected emperor. While consuls were still ceremonially chosen every year, Caracalla inherited power from his father, Septimius Severus, who became emperor by winning a civil war. The most important step Caracalla took to cement his rule was murdering his brother and rival, Geta. When Caracalla ordered the murder of Geta, declared war on the Parthian Empire, or extended Roman citizenship to millions of Britons, Greeks, and Arabs, he had no need to ask permission from the Roman people. All of Rome's self-correcting mechanisms had been neutralized long before. If Caracalla made some error in foreign or domestic policy, neither the Senate nor any officials could intervene to correct it, except by rising in rebellion or assassinating him. And when Caracalla was indeed assassinated in 217, it only led to a new round of civil wars, culminating in the rise of new autocrats. Rome in the 3rd century CE, like Russia in the 18th century, was, in the words of Madame de Stael, autocracy tempered by strangulation. By the 3rd century CE, not only the Roman Empire but all other major human societies on Earth were centralized information networks lacking strong self-correcting mechanisms. This was true of the Parthian and Sasanian empires in Persia, of the Kushan and Gupta empires in India, and of China's Han Empire and its successor, Three Kingdoms. Thousands of more small-scale societies continued to function democratically in the 3rd century CE and beyond, but it seemed that distributed democratic networks were simply incompatible with large-scale societies. Caesar for president. Were large-scale democracies really unworkable in the ancient world? Or did autocrats like Augustus and Caracalla deliberately sabotage them? This question is important, not only for our understanding of ancient history, but also for our view of democracy's future in the age of AI. How do we know whether democracies fail because they are undermined by strongmen or because of much deeper structural and technological reasons? To answer that question, let's take a closer look at the Roman Empire. The Romans were clearly familiar with the democratic ideal, and it continued to be important to them even after the Caesar family rose to power. Otherwise, Augustus and his heirs would not have bothered to maintain seemingly democratic institutions like the Senate or annual elections to the consulate and other offices. So why did power end up in the hands of an unelected emperor? In theory, even after Roman citizenship was expanded to tens of millions of people throughout the Mediterranean basin, wasn't it possible to hold empire-wide elections for the position of emperor? This would surely have required very complicated logistics, and it would have taken several months to learn the results of the elections. But was that really a deal-breaker? The key misconception here is equating democracy with elections. Tens of millions of Roman citizens could theoretically vote for this or that imperial candidate. But the real question we should ask is whether the Roman Empire could have held an ongoing empire-wide political conversation. In present-day North Korea, no democratic conversation takes place because people aren't free to talk. Yet we could well imagine a situation when this freedom is guaranteed, as it is in South Korea. In the present-day United States, the democratic conversation is endangered by people's inability to listen to and respect their political rivals, yet this can presumably still be fixed. By contrast, in the Roman Empire, there was simply no way to conduct or sustain a democratic conversation because the technological means to hold such a conversation did not exist. To hold a conversation, it is not enough to have the freedom to talk and the ability to listen. There are also two technical preconditions. First, people need to be within hearing range of one another. This means that the only way to hold a political conversation in a territory the size of the United States or the Roman Empire is with the help of some kind of information technology that can swiftly convey what people say over long distances. Second, people need at least a rudimentary understanding of what they are talking about. Otherwise, they are just making noise, not holding a meaningful conversation. People usually have a good understanding of political issues of which they have direct experience. Poor people have many insights about poverty that escape economics professors, and ethnic minorities understand racism in a much more profound way than people who never suffered from it, for example. However, if lived experience were the only way to understand crucial political issues, large-scale political conversations would be impossible. for then every group of people could talk meaningfully only about its own experiences. Even worse, nobody else could understand what they were saying. If lived experience is the sole possible source of knowledge, then merely listening to the insights gained from someone else's lived experience cannot impart these insights to me. The only way to have a large-scale political conversation among diverse groups of people is if people can gain some understanding of issues that they have never experienced firsthand. In a large polity, it is a crucial role of the education system and the media to inform people about things they have never faced themselves. If there is no education system or media platform to perform this role, no meaningful large-scale conversations can take place. In a small Neolithic town of a few thousand inhabitants, people might sometimes have been afraid to say what they thought, or might have refused to listen to their rivals. But it was relatively easy to satisfy the more fundamental technical preconditions for meaningful discourse. First, people lived in proximity to one another, so they could easily meet most other community members and hear their voices. Second, everybody had intimate knowledge of the dangers and opportunities that the town faced. If an enemy war party approached, everyone could see it. If the river flooded the fields, everyone witnessed the economic effects. When people talked about war and hunger, they knew what they were saying. In the 4th century BCE, the city-state of Rome was still small enough to allow a large percentage of its citizens to congregate in the forum in times of emergency, listen to respected leaders, and voice their personal views on the matter at hand. When in 390 BCE Gallic invaders attacked Rome, almost everyone lost a relative in the defeat at the Battle of the Allia, and lost property when the victorious Gauls then sacked Rome. The desperate Romans appointed Marcus Camillus as dictator. In Rome, the dictator was a public official appointed in times of emergency, who had unlimited powers, but only for a short predetermined period, following which he was held accountable for his actions. After Camillus led the Romans to victory, everybody could see that the emergency was over, and Camillus stepped down. In contrast, by the 3rd century CE, the Roman Empire had a population of between 60 and 75 million people, spread over 5 million square kilometers. Rome lacked mass communication technology like radio or daily newspapers. Only 10 to 20% of adults had reading skills, and there was no organized education system that could inform them about the geography, history, and economy of the empire. True, many people across the empire did share some cultural ideas, such as a strong belief in the superiority of Roman civilization over the barbarians. These shared cultural beliefs were crucial in preserving order and holding the empire together. But their political implications were far from clear, and in times of crisis, there was no possibility of holding a public conversation about what should be done. How could Syrian merchants, British shepherds, and Egyptian villagers converse about the ongoing wars in the Middle East or about the immigration crisis brewing along the Danube? The lack of a meaningful public conversation was not the fault of Augustus, Nero, Caracalla, or any of the other emperors. They didn't sabotage Roman democracy. Given the size of the empire and the available information technology, democracy was simply unworkable. This was acknowledged already by ancient philosophers like Plato and Aristotle, who argued that democracy can work only in small-scale city-states. If the absence of Roman democracy had merely been the fault of particular autocrats, we should have at least seen large-scale democracies flourishing in other places, like in Sasanian Persia, Gupta India, or Han China. But prior to the development of modern information technology, there are no examples of large-scale democracies anywhere. It should be stressed that in many large-scale autocracies, local affairs were often managed democratically. The Roman emperor didn't have the information needed to micromanage hundreds of cities across the empire, whereas local citizens in each city could continue to hold a meaningful conversation about municipal politics. Consequently, long after the Roman Empire became an autocracy, many of its cities continued to be governed by local assemblies and elected officials. At a time when elections to the consulship in Rome became ceremonial affairs, elections to municipal offices in small cities like Pompeii were hotly contested. Pompeii was destroyed in the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 CE during the reign of the Emperor Titus. Archaeologists uncovered about 1,500 graffiti concerned with various local election campaigns. One coveted office was that of the city's aedile, the magistrate in charge of maintaining the city's infrastructure and public buildings. Lucretius Fronto's supporters drew the graffiti, "If honest living is thought to be any recommendation, then Lucretius Fronto is worthy of being elected." One of his opponents, Gaius Julius Polybius, ran with the slogan, "Elect Gaius Julius Polybius to the office of aedile. He provides good bread." There were also endorsements by religious groups and professional associations, such as the Worshippers of Isis demand the election of Gnaeus Helvius Sabinus, and all the mule drivers request that you elect Gaius Julius Polybius. There was dirty work too. Someone who clearly wasn't Marcus Carinius Vatia drew the graffiti, "All the drunkards ask you to elect Marcus Carinius Vatia," and "The petty thieves ask you to elect Vatia." Such electioneering indicates that the position of aedile had power in Pompeii, and that the aedile was chosen in relatively free and fair elections, rather than appointed by the imperial autocrat in Rome. Even in empires whose rulers never had any democratic pretensions, democracy could still flourish in local settings. In the Tsarist Empire, for example, the daily lives of millions of villagers were managed by rural communes. Going back at least to the 11th century, each commune usually included fewer than 1,000 people. They were subject to a landlord and bore many obligations to their lord and to the central Tsarist state, but they had considerable autonomy in managing their internal affairs and in deciding how to discharge their external obligations, such as paying taxes and providing military recruits. The commune mediated local disputes, provided emergency relief, enforced social norms, oversaw the distribution of land to individual households, and regulated access to shared resources like forests and pastures. Decisions on important matters were made in communal meetings in which the heads of local households expressed their views and chose the commune's elder. Resolutions at least tried to reflect the majority's will. In Tsarist villages and Roman cities, a form of democracy was possible because a meaningful public conversation was possible. Pompeii was a city of about 11,000 people in 79 CE, so everybody could supposedly judge for themselves whether Lucretius Fronto was an honest man and whether Marcus Carinius Vatia was a drunken thief. But democracy at a scale of millions became possible only in the modern age, when mass media changed the nature of large-scale information networks. Mass media makes mass democracy possible. Mass media are information technologies that can quickly connect millions of people even when they are separated by vast distances. The printing press was a crucial step in that direction. Print made it possible to cheaply and quickly produce large numbers of books and pamphlets, which enabled more people to voice their opinions and be heard over a large territory, even if the process still took time. This sustained some of the first experiments in large-scale democracy, such as the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth established in 1569 and the Dutch Republic established in 1579. Some may contest the characterization of these polities as democratic, since only a minority of relatively wealthy citizens enjoyed full political rights. In the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, political rights were reserved for adult male members of the Szlachta, the nobility. These numbered up to 300,000 individuals, or about 5% of the total adult population. One of the Sláinte's prerogatives was to elect the king, but since voting required travelling long distances to a national convention, few exercised their right. In the 16th and 17th centuries, participation in royal elections usually ranged between 3,000 and 7,000 voters, except for the 1669 elections, in which 11,271 participated. While this hardly sounds democratic in the 21st century, it should be remembered that all large-scale democracies until the 20th century limited political rights to a small circle of relatively wealthy men. Democracy is never a matter of all or nothing. It is a continuum, and late 16th century Poles and Lithuanians explored previously unknown regions of that continuum. Aside from electing its king, Poland-Lithuania had an elected parliament, the Sejm, that approved or blocked new legislation and had the power to veto royal decisions on taxation and foreign affairs. Moreover, citizens enjoyed a list of inviolable rights, such as freedom of assembly and freedom of religion. In the late 16th and early 17th centuries, when most of Europe suffered from bitter religious conflicts and persecutions, Poland-Lithuania was a tolerant haven, where Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Lutherans, Calvinists, Jews, and even Muslims coexisted in relative harmony. In 1616, more than 100 mosques functioned in the Commonwealth. In the end, however, the Polish-Lithuanian experiment in decentralization proved to be impractical. The country was Europe's second largest state, after Russia, covering almost 1 million square kilometers and including most of the territory of today's Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. It lacked the information, communication, and education systems necessary to hold a meaningful political conversation between Polish aristocrats, Lithuanian noblemen, Ukrainian Cossacks, and Jewish rabbis spread from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. Its self-correcting mechanisms were also too costly, paralyzing the power of the central government. In particular, every single Sejm deputy was given the right to veto all parliamentary legislation, which led to political deadlock. The combination of a large and diverse polity with a weak centre proved fatal. The Commonwealth was torn apart by centrifugal forces, and its pieces were then divided between the centralized autocracies of Russia, Austria, and Prussia. The Dutch experiment fared better. In some ways, the Dutch United Provinces were even less centralized than the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, since they lacked a monarch, and were a union of 7 autonomous provinces, which were in turn made up of self-governing towns and cities. This decentralized nature is reflected in the plural form of how the country was known abroad. The Netherlands in English, Les Pays-Bas in French, Los Países Bajos in Spanish, and so on. However, taken together, the United Provinces were 25 times smaller in landmass than Poland-Lithuania, and possessed a much better information, communication, and education system that tied its constituent parts closely together. The United Provinces also pioneered a new information technology with a big future. In June 1618, a pamphlet titled Courant uit Italien, Deutschland, etc. appeared in Amsterdam. As its title indicated, it carried news from the Italian peninsula, the German lands, and other places. There was nothing remarkable about this particular pamphlet, except that new issues were published in the following weeks too. They appeared regularly until 1670, when the Courant uit Italien, Deutschland, etc. merged with other serial pamphlets into the Amsterdamische Courant, which appeared until 1903, when it was merged into De Telegraaf, the Netherlands' largest newspaper to this day. The newspaper is a periodic pamphlet, and it was different from earlier one-off pamphlets because it had a much stronger self-correcting mechanism. Unlike one-off publications, a weekly or daily newspaper has a chance to correct its mistakes and an incentive to do so in order to win the public's trust. Shortly after the Courant Uit Italien, Deutschland Itse appeared, a competing newspaper titled Tidingen Uit Verschiedene Quartieren, Tidings from Various Quarters, made its debut. The Courant was generally considered more reliable because it tried to check its stories before publishing them, and because the Tidingen was accused of being overly patriotic and reporting only news favourable to the Netherlands. Nevertheless, both newspapers survived, because, as one reader explained, one can always find something in one newspaper that is not available in the other. In the following decades, dozens of additional newspapers were published in the Netherlands, which became Europe's journalistic hub. Newspapers that succeeded in gaining widespread trust became the architects and mouthpieces of public opinion. They created a far more informed and engaged public, which changed the nature of politics, first in the Netherlands and later around the world. The political influence of newspapers was so crucial that newspaper editors often became political leaders. Jean-Paul Marat rose to power in revolutionary France by founding and editing L'Ami du Peuple. Eduard Bernstein helped create Germany's Social Democratic Party by editing Der Sozialdemokrat. Vladimir Lenin's most important position before becoming Soviet dictator was editor of Iskra. And Benito Mussolini rose to fame first as a socialist journalist in Avanti and later as founder and editor of the firebrand right-wing paper Il Popolo d'Italia. Newspapers played a crucial role in the formation of early modern democracies, like the United Provinces in the Low Countries, the United Kingdom in the British Isles, and the United States in North America. As the names themselves indicate, these were not city-states like ancient Athens and Rome, but amalgams of different regions glued together in part by this new information technology. For example, when on December 6, 1825, President John Quincy Adams gave his first annual message to the US Congress, the text of the address and summaries of the main points were published over the next weeks by newspapers from Boston to New Orleans. At the time, hundreds of newspapers and magazines were being published in the United States. Adams declared his administration's intentions of initiating numerous federal projects, ranging from the construction of roads to the founding of an astronomical observatory, which he poetically named Lighthouse of the Skies. His speech ignited a fierce public debate, much of it conducted in print, between those who supported such big government plans as essential for the development of the United States, and many who preferred a small government approach and saw Adams's plans as federal overreach and an encroachment on states' rights. Northern supporters of the small government camp complained that it was unconstitutional for the federal government to tax the citizens of richer states in order to build roads in poorer states. Southerners feared that a federal government that claims the power to build a lighthouse of the skies in their backyard may one day claim the power to free their slaves, too. Adams was accused of harboring dictatorial ambitions, while the erudition and sophistication of his speech were criticized as elitist and disconnected from ordinary Americans. The public debates over the 1825 message to Congress dealt a severe blow to the reputation of the Adams administration and helped pave the way to Adams' subsequent electoral defeat. In the 1828 presidential elections, Adams lost to Andrew Jackson, a rich slaveholding planter from Tennessee who was successfully rebranded in numerous newspaper columns as the Man of the People, and who claimed that the previous elections were in fact stolen by Adams and by the corrupt Washington elites. Newspapers of the time were of course still slow and limited compared with the mass media of today. Newspapers travelled at the pace of a horse or sailboat, and relatively few people read them regularly. There were no newsstands or street vendors, so people had to buy subscriptions, which were expensive. Average annual subscriptions cost around 1 week's wages for a skilled journeyman. As a result, the total number of subscribers to all US newspapers in 1830 is estimated at just 78,000. Since some subscribers were associations or businesses rather than individuals, and since every copy was probably read by several people, it seems reasonable to assume that regular newspaper readership numbered in the hundreds of thousands. But millions more people rarely, if ever, read newspapers. No wonder that American democracy in those days was a limited affair, and the domain of wealthy white men. In the 1824 elections that brought Adams to power, 1.3 million Americans were theoretically eligible to vote out of an adult population of about 5 million, or around 25%. Only 352,780 people, 7% of the total adult population, actually made use of their right. Adams didn't even win a majority of those who voted. Owing to the quirks of the US electoral system, he became president thanks to the support of just 113,122 voters, or not much more than 2% of adults and 1% of the total population. In Britain at the same time, only about 400,000 people were eligible to vote for Parliament, or around 6% of the adult population. Moreover, 30% of parliamentary seats were not even contested. You may wonder whether we are talking about democracies at all. At a time when the United States had more slaves than voters, more than 1.5 million Americans were enslaved in the early 1820s. Was the United States really a democracy? This is a question of definitions. As with the late 16th century Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, so also with the early 19th century United States, democracy is a relative term. As noted earlier, democracy and autocracy aren't absolutes. They are part of a continuum. In the early 19th century, out of all large-scale human societies, the United States was probably the closest to the democratic end of the continuum. Giving 25% of adults the right to vote doesn't sound like much today, but in 1824 that was a far higher percentage than in the Tsarist, Ottoman or Chinese empires, in which nobody had the right to vote. Besides, as emphasized throughout this chapter, voting is not the only thing that counts. An even more important reason to consider the United States in 1824 a democracy is that compared with most other polities of its day, the new country possessed much stronger self-correcting mechanisms. The founding fathers were inspired by ancient Rome, witness the Senate and the Capitol in Washington, and they were well aware that the Roman Republic eventually turned into an autocratic empire. They feared that some American Caesar would do something similar to their republic, and constructed multiple overlapping self-correcting mechanisms known as the system of checks and balances. One of these was a free press. In ancient Rome, the self-correcting mechanisms stopped functioning as the republic enlarged its territory and population. In the United States, modern information technology combined with freedom of the press helped the self-correcting mechanisms survive even as the country extended from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It was these self-correcting mechanisms that gradually enabled the United States to expand the franchise, abolish slavery, and turn itself into a more inclusive democracy. As noted in Chapter 2, the Founding Fathers committed enormous mistakes, such as endorsing slavery and denying women the vote, but they also provided the tools for their descendants to correct these mistakes. That was their greatest legacy. The 20th century. Mass democracy, but also mass totalitarianism. Printed newspapers were just the first harbinger of the mass media age. During the 19th and 20th centuries, a long list of new communication and transportation technologies, such as the telegraph, the telephone, television, radio, train, steamship, and airplane, supercharged the power of mass media. When Demosthenes gave a public speech in Athens around 350 BCE, it was aimed primarily at the limited audience actually present in the Athenian Agora. When John Quincy Adams gave his first annual message in 1825, his words spread at the pace of a horse. When Abraham Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863, telegraphs, locomotives, and steamships conveyed his words much faster throughout the Union and beyond. The very next day, the New York Times had already reprinted the speech in full, as had numerous other newspapers from the Portland Daily Press in Maine to the Ottumwa Courier in Iowa. As befitting a democracy with strong self-correcting mechanisms in place, the president's speech sparked a lively conversation rather than universal applause. Most newspapers lauded it, but some expressed their doubts. The Chicago Times wrote on November 20 that the cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of President Lincoln. The Patriot and Union, a local newspaper in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, also blasted the silly remarks of the president, and hoped that the veil of oblivion shall be dropped over them and that they shall be no more repeated or thought of. Though the country was in the midst of a civil war, journalists were free to publicly criticize and even ridicule the president. Fast forward a century, and things really picked up speed. For the first time in history, new technologies allowed masses of people spread over vast swathes of territory to connect in real time. In 1960, about 70 million Americans, 39% of the total population, dispersed over the North American continent and beyond, watched the Nixon-Kennedy presidential debates live on television, with millions more listening on the radio. The only effort viewers and listeners had to make was to press a button while sitting in their homes. Large-scale democracy had now become feasible. Millions of people separated by thousands of kilometers could conduct informed and meaningful public debates about the rapidly evolving issues of the day. By 1960, all adult Americans were theoretically eligible to vote, and close to 70 million, about 64% of the electorate, actually did so. Though millions of blacks and other disenfranchised groups were prevented from voting through various voter suppression schemes. As always, we should beware of technological determinism and of concluding that the rise of mass media led to the rise of large-scale democracy. Mass media made large-scale democracy possible rather than inevitable. And it also made possible other types of regimes. In particular, the new information technologies of the modern age opened the door for large-scale totalitarian regimes. Like Nixon and Kennedy, Stalin and Khrushchev could say something over the radio and be heard instantaneously by hundreds of millions of people from Vladivostok to Kaliningrad. They could also receive daily reports by phone and telegraph from millions of secret police agents and informers. If a newspaper in Vladivostok or Kaliningrad wrote that the Supreme Leader's latest speech was silly, as happened to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, then everyone involved, from the editor-in-chief to the typesetters, would likely have received a visit from the KGB. A brief history of totalitarianism. Totalitarian systems assume their own infallibility and seek total control over the totality of people's lives. Before the invention of the telegraph, radio, and other modern information technology, large-scale totalitarian regimes were impossible. Roman emperors, Abbasid caliphs, and Mongol khans were often ruthless autocrats who believed they were infallible. But they did not have the apparatus necessary to impose totalitarian control over large societies. To understand this, we should first clarify the difference between totalitarian regimes and less extreme autocratic regimes. In an autocratic network, there are no legal limits on the will of the ruler, but there are nevertheless a lot of technical limits. In a totalitarian network, many of these technical limits are absent. For example, in autocratic regimes like the Roman Empire, the Abbasid Empire, and the Mongol Empire, rulers could usually execute any person who displeased them, and if some law got in their way, they could ignore or change the law. The Emperor Nero arranged the murder of his mother, Agrippina, and his wife, Octavia, and forced his mentor, Seneca, to commit suicide. Nero also executed or exiled some of the most respected and powerful Roman aristocrats merely for voicing dissent or telling jokes about him. While autocratic rulers like Nero could execute anyone who did or said something that displeased them, they couldn't know what most people in their empire were doing or saying. Theoretically, Nero could issue an order that any person in the Roman Empire who criticized or insulted the emperor must be severely punished. Yet there were no technical means for implementing such an order. Roman historians like Tacitus portray Nero as a bloodthirsty tyrant who instigated an unprecedented reign of terror. But this was a very limited type of terror. Although he executed or exiled a number of family members, aristocrats, and senators within his orbit, ordinary Romans in the city slums and provincials in distant towns like Jerusalem and Londinium could speak their mind much more freely. Modern totalitarian regimes like the Stalinist USSR instigated terror on an altogether different scale. Totalitarianism is the attempt to control what every person throughout the country is doing and saying every moment of the day, and potentially even what every person is thinking and feeling. Nero might have dreamed about such powers, but he lacked the means to realize them. Given the limited tax base of the agrarian Roman economy, Nero couldn't employ many people in his service. He could place informers at the dinner parties of Roman senators, but he had only about 10,000 imperial administrators and 350,000 soldiers to control the rest of the empire, and he lacked the technology to communicate with them swiftly. Nero and his fellow emperors had an even bigger problem ensuring the loyalty of the administrators and soldiers they did have on their payroll. No Roman emperor was ever toppled by a democratic revolution like the ones that deposed Louis XVI, Nicolae Ceausescu, or Hosni Mubarak. Instead, dozens of emperors were assassinated or deposed by their own generals, officials, bodyguards, or family members. Nero himself was overthrown by a revolt of the governor of Hispania, Galba. 6 months later, Galba was ousted by Otho, the governor of Lusitania. Within 3 months, Otho was deposed by Vitellius, commander of the Rhine army. Vitellius lasted about 8 months before he was defeated and killed by Vespasian, commander of the army in Judea. Being killed by a rebellious subordinate was the biggest occupational hazard not just for Roman emperors, but for almost all pre-modern autocrats. Emperors, caliphs, shahs, and kings found it a huge challenge to keep their subordinates in check. Rulers consequently focused their attention on controlling the military and the taxation system. Roman emperors had the authority to interfere in the local affairs of any province or city, and they sometimes exercised that authority, but this was usually done in response to a specific petition sent by a local community or official, rather than as part of some empire-wide totalitarian 5-year plan. If you were a mule driver in Pompeii, or a shepherd in Roman Britain, Nero didn't want to control your daily routines or police the jokes you told. As long as you paid your taxes and didn't resist the legions, that was good enough for Nero. Sparta and Chin. Some scholars claim that despite the technological difficulties, there were attempts to establish totalitarian regimes in ancient times. The most common example cited is Sparta. According to this interpretation, Spartans were ruled by a totalitarian regime that micromanaged every aspect of their lives, from whom they married to what they ate. However, while the Spartan regime was certainly draconian, it actually included several self-correcting mechanisms that prevented power from being monopolized by a single person or faction. Political authority was divided between two kings, 5 ephors, senior magistrates, 28 members of the Gerousia Council, and the Popular Assembly. Important decisions, such as whether to go to war, often involved fierce public debates. Moreover, irrespective of how we evaluate the nature of Sparta's regime, it is clear that the same technological limitations that confined ancient Athenian democracy to a single city also limited the scope of the Spartan political experiment. After winning the Peloponnesian War, Sparta installed military garrisons and pro-Spartan governments in numerous Greek cities, requiring them to follow its lead in foreign policy and sometimes also pay tribute. But unlike the USSR after World War II, Sparta after the Peloponnesian War did not try to expand or export its system. Sparta couldn't construct an information network big and dense enough to control the lives of ordinary people in every Greek town and village. A much more ambitious totalitarian project might have been launched by the Qin dynasty in ancient China, 221 to 206 BCE. After defeating all the other warring states, the Qin ruler, Qin Shi Huang, controlled a huge empire with tens of millions of subjects who belonged to numerous different ethnic groups, spoke diverse languages, and were loyal to various local traditions and elites. To cement its power, the victorious Qin regime tried to dismantle any regional powers that might challenge its authority. It confiscated the lands and wealth of local aristocrats and forced regional elites to move to the imperial capital of Xiangyang, thereby separating them from their power base and monitoring them more easily. The Qin regime also embarked on a ruthless campaign of centralization and homogenization. It created a new simplified script to be used throughout the empire and standardized coinage, weights, and measurements. It built a road network radiating out of Xiangyang with standardized rest houses, relay stations, and military checkpoints. People needed written permits in order to enter or leave the capital region or frontier zones. Even the width of axles was standardized to ensure that carts and chariots could run in the same ruts. Every action, from tilling fields to getting married, was supposed to serve some military need, and the type of military discipline that Rome reserved for the legions was imposed by the Qin on the entire population. The envisioned reach of this system can be exemplified by one Qin law that specified the punishment an official faced if he neglected a granary under his supervision. The law discusses the number of rat holes in the granary that would warrant fining or berating the official. For 3 or more rat holes, the fine is the purchase of 1 shield for the army, and for 2 or fewer, the responsible official is berated. 3 mouse holes are equal to 1 rat hole. To facilitate this totalitarian system, the Qin attempted to create a militarized social order. Every male subject had to belong to a 5-man unit. These units were aggregated into larger formations, from local hamlets, li, through cantons, zhang, and counties, xian, all the way to the large imperial commanderies, jun. People were forbidden to change their residence without permit, to the extent that guests could not even stay overnight at a friend's house without proper identification and authorization. Every Qin male subject was also given a rank, just as every soldier in an army has a rank. Obedience to the state resulted in promotion to higher ranks, which brought with it economic and legal privileges, while disobedience could result in demotion or punishment. People in each formation were supposed to supervise one another, and if any individual committed some misdeed, all could be punished for it. Anyone who failed to report a criminal, even their own relatives, would be killed. Those who reported crimes were rewarded with higher ranks and other perks. It is highly questionable to what extent the regime managed to implement all these totalitarian measures. Bureaucrats writing documents in a government office often invent elaborate rules and regulations which then turn out to be impractical. Did conscientious government officials really go around the entire Qin Empire counting rat holes in every granary? Were peasants in every remote mountain hamlet really organized into five-man squads? Probably not. Nevertheless, the Qin Empire outdid other ancient empires in its totalitarian ambitions. The Qin regime even tried to control what its subjects were thinking and feeling. During the Warring States period, Chinese thinkers were relatively free to develop myriad ideologies and philosophies, but the Qin adopted the doctrine of legalism as the official state ideology. Legalism posited that humans were naturally greedy, cruel, and egotistical. It emphasized the need for strict control, argued that punishments and rewards were the most effective means of control, and insisted that state power not be curtailed by any moral consideration. Might was right, and the good of the state was the supreme good. The Qin prescribed other philosophies, such as Confucianism and Taoism, which believed humans were more altruistic and which emphasized the importance of virtue rather than violence. Books espousing such soft views were banned, as well as books that contradicted the official Qin version of history. When one scholar argued that Qin Shi Huang should emulate the founder of the ancient Zhou dynasty and decentralize state power, the Qin chief minister, Li Si, countered that scholars should stop criticizing present-day institutions by idealizing the past. The regime ordered the confiscation of all books that romanticized antiquity or otherwise criticized the Qin. Such problematic texts were stored in the imperial library and could be studied only by official scholars. The Qin Empire was probably the most ambitious totalitarian experiment in human history prior to the modern age, and its scale and intensity would prove to be its ruin. The attempt to regiment tens of millions of people along military lines and to monopolize all resources for military purposes led to severe economic problems, wastefulness, and popular resentment. The regime's draconian laws, along with its hostility to regional elites and its voracious appetite for taxes and recruits, fanned the flames of this resentment even further. Meanwhile, the limited resources of an ancient agrarian society couldn't support all the bureaucrats and soldiers that the Qin needed to contain this resentment, and the low efficiency of their information technology made it impossible to control every town and village from distant Xiangyang. Not surprisingly, in 209 BCE, a series of revolts broke out, led by regional elites, disgruntled commoners, and even some of the empire's own newly minted officials. According to one account, the first serious revolt started when a group of conscripted peasants sent to work in the frontier zone were delayed by rain and flooding. They feared they would be executed for this dereliction of duty and felt they had nothing to lose. They were quickly joined by numerous other rebels. Just 15 years after reaching the apogee of power, the Qin Empire collapsed under the weight of its totalitarian ambitions, splintering into 18 kingdoms. After several years of war, a new dynasty, the Han, reunited the empire. But the Han then adopted a more realistic, less draconian attitude. Han emperors were certainly autocratic, but they were not totalitarian. They did not recognize any limits on their authority, but they did not try to micromanage everyone's lives. Instead of following legalist ideas of surveillance and control, the Han turned to Confucian ideas of encouraging people to act loyally and responsibly out of inner moral convictions. Like their contemporaries in the Roman Empire, Han emperors sought to control only some aspects of society from the center, while leaving considerable autonomy to provincial aristocrats and local communities. Due largely to the limitations imposed by the available information technology, pre-modern large-scale polities like the Roman and Han empires gravitated toward non-totalitarian autocracy. Full-blown totalitarianism might have been dreamed about by the likes of the Qin, but its implementation had to wait for the development of modern technology. The Totalitarian Trinity. Just as modern technology enabled large-scale democracy, it also made large-scale totalitarianism possible. Beginning in the 19th century, the rise of industrial economies allowed governments to employ many more administrators, and new information technologies, such as the telegraph and radio, made it possible to quickly connect and supervise all these administrators. This facilitated an unprecedented concentration of information and power for those who dreamed about such things. When the Bolsheviks seized control of Russia after the 1917 revolution, they were driven by exactly such a dream. The Bolsheviks craved unlimited power because they believed they had a messianic mission. Marx taught that for millennia, all human societies were dominated by corrupt elites who oppressed the people. The Bolsheviks claimed they knew how to finally end all oppression and create a perfectly just society on Earth. But to do so, they had to overcome numerous enemies and obstacles, which, in turn, required all the power they could get. They refused to countenance any self-correcting mechanisms that might question either their vision or their methods. Like the Catholic Church, the Bolshevik Party was convinced that, though its individual members might err, the party itself was always right. Belief in their own infallibility led the Bolsheviks to destroy Russia's nascent democratic institutions, like elections, independent courts, the free press, and opposition parties, and to create a one-party totalitarian regime. Bolshevik totalitarianism did not start with Stalin. It was evident from the very first days of the revolution. It stemmed from the doctrine of party infallibility, rather than from the personality of Stalin. In the 1930s and 1940s, Stalin perfected the totalitarian system he inherited. The Stalinist network was composed of three main branches. First, there was the governmental apparatus of state ministries, regional administrations, and regular Red Army units, which in 1939 comprised 1.6 million civilian officials and 1.9 million soldiers. Second, there was the apparatus of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and its ubiquitous party cells, which in 1939 included 2.4 million party members. Third, there was the secret police. First known as the Cheka, in Stalin's days it was called the OGPU, NKVD, and MGB, and after Stalin's death it morphed into the KGB. Its post-Soviet successor organization has been known since 1995 as the FSB. In 1937, the NKVD had 270,000 agents and millions of informers. The three branches operated in parallel. Just as democracy is maintained by having overlapping self-correcting mechanisms that keep each other in check, modern totalitarianism created overlapping surveillance mechanisms that keep each other in order. The governor of a Soviet province was constantly watched by the local party commissar, and neither of them knew who among their staff was an NKVD informer. A testimony to the effectiveness of the system is that modern totalitarianism largely solved the perennial problem of pre-modern autocracies, revolts by provincial subordinates. While the USSR had its share of court coups, not once did a provincial governor or a Red Army front commander rebel against the center. Much of the credit for that goes to the secret police, which kept a close eye on the mass of citizens, on provincial administrators, and even more so on the party and the Red Army. While in most polities throughout history, the army had wielded enormous political power, in 20th century totalitarian regimes, the regular army ceded much of its clout to the secret police, the Information Army. In the USSR, the Cheka, OGPU, NKVD and KGB lacked the firepower of the Red Army, but had more influence in the Kremlin and could terrorize and purge even the army brass. The East German Stasi and the Romanian Securitate were similarly stronger than the regular armies of these countries. In Nazi Germany, the SS was more powerful than the Wehrmacht, and the SS chief, Heinrich Himmler, was higher up the pecking order than Wilhelm Keitel, chief of the Wehrmacht High Command. In none of these cases could the secret police defeat the regular army in traditional warfare, of course. What made the secret police powerful was its command of information. It had the information necessary to preempt a military coup and to arrest the commanders of tank brigades or fighter squadrons before they knew what hit them. During the Stalinist Great Terror of the late 1930s, out of 144,000 Red Army officers, about 10% were shot or imprisoned by the NKVD. This included 154 of 186 divisional commanders, 83%, 8 of 9 admirals, 89%, 13 of 15 full generals, 87%, and 3 of 5 marshals, 60%. The party leadership fared just as badly. Of the revered old Bolsheviks, people who joined the party before the 1917 revolution, about a third didn't survive the Great Terror. Of the 33 men who served on the Politburo between 1919 and 1938, 14 were shot, 42%. Of the 139 members and candidate members of the party's Central Committee in 1934, 98, 70%, were shot. Only 2% of the delegates who took part in the 17th Party Congress in 1934 evaded execution, imprisonment, expulsion, or demotion, and attended the 18th Party Congress in 1939. The secret police, which did all the purging and killing, was itself divided into several competing branches that closely watched and purged one another. Genrikh Jagoda, the NKVD head who orchestrated the beginning of the Great Terror and supervised the killing of hundreds of thousands of victims, was executed in 1938 and replaced by Nikolai Yeshov. Yeshov lasted for 2 years, killing and imprisoning millions of people before being executed in 1940. Perhaps most telling is the fate of the 39 people who in 1935 held the rank of general in the NKVD, called Commissars of State Security in Soviet nomenclature. 35 of them, 90%, were arrested and shot by 1941. One was assassinated, and one, the head of the NKVD's Far East Regional Office, saved himself by defecting to Japan, but was killed by the Japanese in 1945. Of the original cohort of 39 NKVD generals, only 2 men were left standing by the end of World War II. The remorseless logic of totalitarianism eventually caught up with them too. During the power struggles that followed Stalin's death in 1953, one of them was shot, while the other was consigned to a psychiatric hospital, where he died in 1960. Serving as an NKVD general in Stalin's day was one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. At a time when American democracy was improving its many self-correcting mechanisms, Soviet totalitarianism was refining its triple self-surveilling and self-terrorizing apparatus. Total control. Totalitarian regimes are based on controlling the flow of information and are suspicious of any independent channels of information. When military officers, state officials or ordinary citizens exchange information, they can build trust. If they come to trust one another, they can organize resistance to the regime. Therefore, a key tenet of totalitarian regimes is that wherever people meet and exchange information, the regime should be there too, to keep an eye on them. In the 1930s, this was one principle that Hitler and Stalin shared. On March 31, 1933, 2 months after Hitler became Chancellor, the Nazis passed the Coordination Act, Gleichschaltungsgesetz. This stipulated that by April 30, 1933, all political, social and cultural organizations throughout Germany, from municipalities to football clubs and local choirs, must be run according to Nazi ideology, as organs of the Nazi state. It upended life in every city and hamlet in Germany. For example, in the small Alpine village of Oberstdorf, the democratically elected municipal council met for the last time on April 21, 1933. And 3 days later, it was replaced by an unelected Nazi council that appointed a Nazi mayor. Since the Nazis alone allegedly knew what the people really wanted, who other than Nazis could implement the people's will? Oberstdorf also had about 50 associations and clubs, ranging from a beekeeping society to an alpinist club. They all had to conform to the Coordination Act, adjusting their boards, membership, and statutes to Nazi demands, hoisting the swastika flag, and concluding every meeting with the Horst Wessel song.